Good morning and welcome to Step Into the Light. We're your hosts. I'm Patty Sheen.
And I'm Jeanelle Feary. Thank you for listening.
Together, we will introduce you to people who have found their way out of the dark shadows of life and back to light.
And those who, through various ministries and creative endeavors, lead others on their journey from darkness to light.
We hope that today's episode will give you tools to find your way out of a disheartening journey, a difficult circumstance, a depressing situation.
Today's guest, high school teacher, writer, and editor, Lynn Tagawa. Lynn is the author of San Houston's Republic and the 18th century fictional Russell series, which includes The Shenandoah Road, a novel of the Great Awakening, and The Heart of Courage, a novel of the French and Indian War. Lynn is a member of the Christian Pen and the American Christian Fiction Writers. Three of her favorite things are coffee, chocolate, and best of all, her five grandchildren. Lynn resides in South Texas with her family. Lynn, welcome to the show.
Hi, I am really honored and privileged to be here. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for joining us. So to start, Lynn, share with us a bit about your professional background. When did you know you wanted to be a teacher, and what grades have you taught?
Well, I discovered teaching in college, obviously, but I wasn't going into college thinking about it. That was a time of change for me. The Lord saved me in my freshman year and gave me a different perspective about things, and I realized what a poor fit I was for electrical engineering, which was my first major. I ended up in science teaching. I began teaching science to high schoolers, and today I teach co-op classes for homeschoolers. So it's been a long road in terms of both the subjects that I teach. I am now focused on history and writing, and the focus of whether, you know, I'm in the classroom or not. And so that has changed a bit over time as well.
Sure. And what an interesting journey you've taken as well.
Yes.
Well, Lynn, that makes me kind of want to ask, has there been some, did you have some maybe communication interaction with someone or an experience that kind of confirmed for you that God was telling you, hey, you need to switch gears here? Was there like a big sign on the principal's door that said, Lynn, you need to start teaching history? Or, you know, we joke about, you know, if only God would send one of those planes across the sky with a big message telling us what to do. Did you
yes,
have anything that's... like that that kind of was like, oh, okay, this is where I'm supposed to go?
Kind of. I was teaching science and math at a small Christian school. Our church had a school, and really enjoying that. And the principal came to me one day and he said, we need a curriculum for Texas history. I live in Texas, and that's a thing here where, you know, you eighth grade and actually fourth grade too, there's a special class, and we didn't have one. And so he hands me a textbook, and I look at it, and it's boring. I mean, do these history textbooks, are they written by committee? And then he hands me another book, and the book was the memoirs of a Baptist preacher who came into Texas before it was a state, obviously. And this was about the time Sam Houston came on down. And he had some really interesting stories to tell. But I realized right away that just the memoir of a single guy was not going to work for a curriculum. And I ended up writing a curriculum myself. And so that was huge because here I am, a science teacher, and talk about feeling like an imposter. You know, It's not even my subject. I'm not even a native Texan. And here I am. I've got a whole shelf of books on Texas and Sam Houston and all of these things.
What an undertaking.
So,
that sounds fabulous.
Yes.
Was it rewarding to you as well to get that done?
Oh, it was really fun. It was really fun. And my goal was to make something interesting, and I wrote it as a narrative. I thought, well, I'm not going to write like these other committee textbook thing. I'm going to write it like a novel. And so I took the real events, the real words, the real quotes, and I thought, you know, you just can't make this stuff up. It's
right.
So interesting all by itself. It just needs to be presented in an interesting way. So even that nonfiction production, which we ended up getting it published as an actual book. That was my husband's idea. Sam Houston's Republic is actually a curriculum, but it's written like a novel. And that's what kind of gave me the idea of, well, you know, maybe I could write actual fiction. And that was the whole shift, both into history, and that's what eventually got me into historical fiction.
Wow.
One thing growing from the next. That is fantastic.
Mm.
Isn't that the way sometimes? God just leads us down a path, but we never would have dreamed of taking ourselves. So I love to hear those stories, Lynn. Thank you for sharing that
with
us. Yeah,
me too. And it really built, you could feel the foundation being built, right? I mean, I don't know that you would have, without your husband's encouragement, recognized that, hey, this could be something even more.
Yes. He was the one who looked around and saw the piles of stuff. And he said, well, you know, what about a publisher? You know, so it was his idea, really. And so that was another thing.
Very good.
Well, if I could share real quick with you guys, my experience with history was not good when I was in school. I mean, I wasn't a straight A student or anything, but I did fairly well with A's and B's, and I always enjoyed getting my report card like a lot of kids don't, but I always enjoyed getting it to see how I had done. And for some reason, mm-hmm. this one year, they put our midterm grade on our report cards, and we came into class after taking our exam, and the teacher said, four of you failed this test. And I thought, oh, phew, there's got to be four kids in this class of 36 that are dumber than me. I got a 52 on that test.
Oh, no.
And they put it on my report card in red, and I cried all the way home. So I hated history after that. I just hated it.
Yeah,
but
I can imagine.
Over the years now that I'm out here where I am in Colorado, and there's so much rich history here, I kind of wish I had paid closer attention to history back then. Well, now with things going on politically and everything, I really wish I had paid closer attention, you know, but I still remember that,
yes.
Having that ugly red mark on my report card and crying all the way home.
Yeah. And Lynn, I had to chuckle when you said, you know, it was so boring. And I'm like, oh my gosh, haven't we all been there? I didn't care for history at all because of that. I would have loved to have had you done the curriculum I had to read because, it's just so stagnant. And to your point, if you use the real words, it is just phenomenal, action-packed, exciting. But I hate to say they dumb it down, but they do something to it that makes it just as drab as can be.
Yes.
And I can't say that I'm an expert in writing curricula. I just did it for my class, for the kids.
Because it had to be done.
And
yeah.
Yes, it had to be done.
That's great. So tell me, Lynn, in what ways have you seen the curriculum and the culture change over the years? What has been dramatic that you've noticed?
Well, there was already some of that even when I was in school, and that's going back a ways, you know, 1970s. And
sure.
You're starting to get the change of we have to please these groups. And we're getting into group mentality instead of heroes.
Okay.
The old way we looked at history, we looked at prominent individuals. And that's not all we did. But, and you see a resurgence of some of this. Like, if you've ever read any of David McCullough, he wrote biographies of John Adams and Harry Truman, and people just lapped it up, and they made John Adams into a miniseries on HBO. And people love it because this is the kind of thing we want to see. We want to see historical figures who are real people and they have feet of clay. I enjoy looking into Sam Houston that way. He had feet of clay, but there were things about him that were instructive. And to use these kind of men as, if I dare call them heroes, that's the way history used to be taught. Today we downplay any of the importance of historical figures per se, and we talk about the larger movements, the social issues, the economic issues, and there's nothing wrong with that in and of itself. We could talk about the Industrial Revolution, how that affected people. That's always going to be there. But there is a shift, not only there, but then what has become really dangerous in recent days has to do with political correctness. You can't ask questions anymore. You have a narrative you have to communicate. And now, for example, in my original field, which is biology, talk about in a public school the problems with the theory of evolution. You can't ask the questions, well, why didn't we find these things that Darwin predicted? And so today that's come full circle, and it affects literature and history as well, where you can't ask those questions. So, yeah, things have really shifted.
Absolutely. And along that same vein, Lynn, there's a push to erase, if that's the correct word, certain historical events from the school curriculum even, and you're reading about the statues that are being removed and all these kind of things, and no matter what side you're on politically, I just have a concern about that, and there is an emphasis placed more on social studies and socioeconomic issues than actual history that affects students' perception of history.
I have learned a lot more in my studies as a writer, and it causes me to ask the question, why wasn't I taught all this history when I went to school?
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't even this bad. Now, there are so many things that, we have Black History Month. Well, that's nice. But as a teacher, I am so aware that, you know, if you want to focus on something, that is a day or a week that you cannot speak about other things. And so things tend to get erased that way. And we also have this really dangerous kind of subtle problem of focusing on the wrong, the bad. I'm not saying we shouldn't, but let's say, you know, I spoke of all of these heroes having feet of clay. You know, we can talk about Sam Houston's problem with alcohol. Well, he did, but in a way that just makes him more human and more likable.
Yes.
We don't focus on that. We just, you know, we talk about it and then we move on. But we are told over and over that Jefferson had children by a slave. And this becomes a focus. We forget about his importance in history. And it all becomes like an episode of The View where folks are just throwing comments around and nothing profitable gets learned, we lose the ideas. And this is another thing I was thinking about. Today, all cultures and all ideas are equal. Nothing is truly evil unless it has to do with traditional ideas or Christian values, which, you know, we get the subtle message that anything to do with Christians is dangerous. And so we're left with feelings, and we can't explain really important events. We don't know how Hitler came to power. We know what he looked like. We know maybe that he killed 6 million Jews, but how did he get the rest of the country along to do that? And if we don't understand enough about history, if we don't ask the questions, then those things will be repeated today.
That is a great point, Lynn. And I wonder, just as you're describing it to me, if it feels to you like almost a pendulum swinging, because as you describe it, it sounds like we've gone from one extreme of these people being heroes and possibly perfect people to revealing what in their past is imperfect and not good, but instead of it making them seem more human, it actually taints the good things that they did in their life, when we all understand there's only one perfect and that God resides in heaven and not on earth, but that it's okay to be imperfect, but instead of it, again, making it seem like a real person, it's just tainting their whole story.
Yes, it's tainting their whole story, and we don't get the time to explain, you know, like with Jefferson, he did some amazing things. And
yes,
the one thing at the end of his life that he was most proud of was the Virginia Statute of Religious Liberty. And I didn't even know that until I started.
I am not familiar
studying
with that. Yeah.
No, I'm not either.
Because in Virginia, this comes out in Heart of Courage, you had to have a special license to preach if you weren't part of the established church. You had to pay tithes to the established church, which was the Church of England. And so let's say you're a Baptist. Well, you might end up getting thrown in jail if you preach outside certain boundaries. And a lot of them did. They got beaten by mobs. They got thrown in jail. And Jefferson was looking at this and saying, this isn't right. And he was a free thinker. He was not a Christian. I don't think we can say that. But, you know, I think he felt that all must attend the Church of England, and they did. You know, he felt the constraint of that and thought that's not right. And so he got this bill passed finally, and that was the greatest accomplishment of his life.
Wow.
How interesting. That is great.
Yes, and you know,
well,
now that you talk about that, Lynn, I think I saw something about that it was a YouTube presentation that I watched. It's been quite a while ago, so I can't even remember what the presentation was about, but it had something to do with religious liberty and freedom, and I'm pretty sure that was brought up there. Let's go to a real quick break. Folks, you're listening to Step Into the Light. We are your hosts, Patty Sheen and Lynn Alfieri. We are pleased to have guest Lynn Tagawa with us today. Lynn is a high school teacher. She is also a writer and an editor. She is the author of Sam Houston's Republic and the 18th Century Fictional Russell series, which includes to this point two books, The Shenandoah Road and a novel of the Great Awakening, and The Heart of Courage, a novel of the French and Indian War. And I know she has a third one in progress, and maybe she'll talk to us a little bit about that here in a minute. In the meantime, if you have enjoyed this podcast, we'd like to refer it to friends and family, and you can find it on my website, which is pattysheen.com. That's spelled P-A-T-T-I-S-H-E-N-E. Simply go to the Blog Talk Radio tab at the top of the page, and there you will find a link to all of the podcasts to date. Also, for information about Lynn, her website, her social media presences, links to her books, you will find a more information tab under each podcast link, and that will give you all the information about Lynn. So far we've been talking a little bit about Lynn's past experiences as a teacher and some of the things that she has learned about how the culture has changed in education today, the impact that has had on students. During the second half of our show today, we are going to talk about Lynn's books, and this is exciting. I read one of them, and she is an excellent author. If you want to learn about history through a fictional setting, I would highly recommend Lynn. So with that, you, as I said, you have written two books in the Russell series, Lynn, and the first book deals with the Great Awakening. The second book deals with the French and Indian War. Not real popular, should I say, or you don't see the market flooded with these particular periods in American history. So talk to us about these books and why you chose those particular time periods.
Actually, the idea for the one set in the Great Awakening came about because I realized that nobody was really writing about that, or, you know, had books set in that time period. Now, I do have a book here on my shelf by Douglas Bond, who's an excellent, excellent historical fiction writer. And he has a collection for teen boys. He has really interesting books that are, I guess you'd call juvenile or even young adult. And he has one that is set during this time period. And I picked it up and I thought, wow, you can do this and do it well. But, you know, that was just one example, and it was a juvenile. And I thought, well, I'd like to write something for adults. Although, of course, because I teach, I still was, you know, had some thoughts regarding my students. And so I thought, obviously, it's going to be clean so they can read it too. They, you know, how precocious teens are. They'll read everything.
Oh, yes.
And so I had that in mind, but even as I thought about it, I thought, well, you know, the Great Awakening had influence on the entire colonies. I mean, it wasn't just one spot. It had a really huge impact. And that impact, I believe, extended all the way to the American Revolution. I think that it affected the way people thought, and it reinforced Christian thought and tradition, if I can use that word, because not everybody obviously was a converted Christian, but it reinforced that Christian worldview. So that when the revolution happened, we had a nation of people who thought in a certain way, and we did not fall into the excesses of the French Revolution. Really, the American Revolution was unique in history. And so I had all of these thoughts going on. Even as I began to write The Shenandoah Road, I was kind of looking ahead. And I determined that this would be a trilogy and that I would, you know, keep the same family of people so that there was this continuity. And I started writing, and always front and center in my writing is the gospel. I have characters who are Christians. I have characters who are not Christians. And in The Shenandoah Road, I have a character who thinks she's a Christian.
Yes.
It's one of those situations where, you know, you grow up in a Christian home and you haven't done anything really bad. And in her case, she didn't really understand the gospel itself. When she does, and when things start to impact her, including bits of a sermon by George Whitefield, she starts to, you know, at first she's very disturbed. So this was another thing that I really was interested in developing. And Patty read the book, so maybe you remember this. I did not create a situation where, oh, I see that I'm lost. I see that I need Christ, and then boom, she's saved.
Salvation in some books. Yeah, I hear what you're saying, Lynn.
Yeah, yeah. This was more difficult, and I have personally observed this, that especially when a person is already religious, sometimes the whole spiritual journey becomes problematic and difficult because they have to unlearn certain things.
Mm-hmm.
And so here she is, she's learning that she's a sinner, and that's huge. She's got to deal with that, and then she has to deal with what the gospel is. She's having to rethink everything. And in my story, there's a little bit of a romance there where it's actually her husband who is teaching her. And so this is another element. But she finally comes to faith. But it is a journey. And you see this, in fact, if I can give another little blurb for Sam Houston, he went through a spiritual journey as well, where he had some misconceived notions that hindered him. But the Lord saved him when he was a senator from the state of Texas. So he came to faith. I wrote that. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I think many, you know, I can't remember a particular point in my life. I mean, I've had guests come on the show and say, I was saved when I was 12 years old in the Methodist Church in Marion, Illinois or something, you know, and I can still remember everybody that was there. And I just don't have any point in time that I can pinpoint that, but I don't feel any less saved. I mean, I know I am. And there have been times when, you know, when I think, oh, for a long time, there were times when I thought, oh, gee, you know, maybe I better make this commitment again, because what if I really didn't do it? You know, and of course, as you grow in your spiritual journey, you realize that you don't necessarily have to have, you know, January 27th, 1973 at 10 o'clock in the morning, you know, in your mind.
And, I know.
Yeah,
I know.
I like the way you did that, Lynn.
Yes, and I know that is true, because I can pin it down to a weekend, and then I have to look back and I say, yeah, but I think God was working in my life before that. So it's a good thing he knows, he's in charge, and we just follow. And so, yes, but there are things that are, they're like pillars of the faith. And this was another thing I learned as I studied. I'm a Baptist, and I'm a Baptist by conviction. But, you know, in my life as a Christian, I've noticed that we don't make a big deal of things like confessions of faith. Now, some churches do, some traditions do. They have catechisms and so forth. Well, in studying the 18th century, I realized that most churches did. They were big on this. They had, you know, the Presbyterians had the Westminster Confession of Faith, and they had a catechism, and, you know, all the New England people, wow, they were into that too. They were Congregationalists, very serious about the faith. And so we have this history as a nation, actually, where we have these confessions of faith that are extremely important. And as I began studying, now, you know, there's a Baptist confession too. To me, you know, I always thought, well, this is kind of man-made. But as I studied it more, I realized these are the Ebenezers of the faith. These are the pillars. These are the things that mark the struggles of our forefathers. We have spiritual forefathers all the way back to the early church fathers, and they struggled and wrestled, and there were heresies that came up, and then they would have to deal with things. And that's where all of our creeds come from.
Yes.
Where they would have to deal with something. And so I look now with a lot greater respect for these things that, wow, this was a spiritual struggle, and they had to write something down, and this is important. So, yeah, it was just a wonderful time of getting to know these things and things that maybe we don't put an emphasis on today.
Sadly, we don't.
Right. Yes. And thank you for talking about your journey through that, Lynn. It's very interesting to hear what you gained yourself as you created these stories. Can you give us a little teaser about what you're working on now? It sounds like there's a third book possibly on the way.
Yes. Yes, there's a third book. And as I mentioned, this was always planned. So I dropped little hints along the way. So, Patty, if you pick up The Heart of Courage, you'll see that one of my characters is returning a book to John Russell. And that book happens to be Samuel Rutherford's Lex Rex, or The Law and the King. Now, that book got Samuel Rutherford exiled. And, well, who was Samuel Rutherford? He was a Scottish minister who is just really loved today for his devotional letters, just a really godly man. But he got in trouble because he wrote about the king. This was a political treatise, actually. He wanted to prove from the scriptures that there were times when a king could be a tyrant, and what to do, what a Christian should do, how a Christian should think about that. And he used the example of David and Saul. And so I dropped that in there. My characters know about it. All of the Presbyterian ministers would have been very familiar with all of this. In fact, all of the colonists knew English history. And Charles I, who exiled Rutherford, he was eventually executed by Parliament. Do y'all remember that? Did you learn about that in school?
I did not. No, I did not.
I did not know either.
If I did, I don't remember it. I must be honest.
Yeah, I mean, this is huge. You cut the head off a king, and then you have to ask why. Well, he was running roughshod over the rights of Englishmen, and Parliament was getting mad. And, I mean, if you think today, you know, that today's politics is getting, you know, really rowdy, well, that's kind of what happened then.
Wow.
And they executed him. And Parliament set up some kind of system for a while. And then Charles II came into power. So there was that. But the interesting thing is that this whole scenario, this whole calling King Charles on the carpet, if you will, was brought up in the colonies. They said, look, kings don't have an absolute right. And so when King George started to do stuff, they started talking about King Charles. And Patrick Henry said something like, Caesar had his Brutus, and King Charles had his, and he started to apply it to King George, and he got censured for that because it was a treasonous statement, essentially. But that's what people were thinking privately. And so now I'm having to grapple with all of that. And so I picked out some characters, and I'll just give you a preview so you can get an idea of where this is going. I'm sticking with my Russell family. I've got these Scots-Irish people who are definitely going to be on Washington's side. And so I've got Jonathan Russell, who is the son of the original character, John Russell, in the first book. And we also have a distant relation who lives in Boston, and she's the daughter of a printer, and she is very much a loyalist. Or at least she, that Romans 13 tells us to obey our magistrates and honor the king and so forth. So she doesn't feel that she can disobey that, at least not at first. And so we'll just have to see what happens with her. And then I have a third character, because I really like throwing in points of view that are different. And this third character is a British officer who goes undercover as a spy. And that was a lot of fun creating him.
I bet. It sounds very James Bondish.
Yeah.
So I'm going to include a little romance, like I always do. And that interpersonal, interactions. I mean, can you imagine if Jonathan Russell falls for this printer's daughter? I mean, they're going to have some fights.
Uh-oh.
Yeah.
Talk about some tension.
Yes.
Tension and conflict in your story.
Uh-huh. So that's basically a preview.
Thank you for that. You've talked about a bit about how you are able to weave God through your stories. What can readers learn about God and perhaps about themselves from your novels?
Well, my stories are very much theological novels. And the word theology, I think, kind of scares us. It's like, oh, that's for ministers, that's for preachers. And to be honest, I have to agree. I'm just beyond the real basics. I've got books on my shelf that I have never read. I've got Calvin's Institutes, which I mentioned in The Heart of Courage, and I have never read that. I mean, I just don't have a need to study systematic theology, and most Christians don't.
Right.
But we need that basic truth that is included in the Gospels. And when we speak of God, or when we speak of the person and work of Christ, if we speak of believing on Christ, well, what does that mean exactly? The Shawnee had an idea of God. They saw him as a creator. I have a Shawnee character in my second book. And they can't have a relationship with a distant creator. And so instead, they put their reliance on these spirits, animals and so forth, your personal spirit and so forth. So we see that they are ignorant of the true God. Theology brings us into that living relationship with God. And my novels weave in some of these actual theological terms like imputation and propitiation, things that we may not actually know, and yet I bring it in a natural way. I brought in imputation in the Shenandoah Road as a term. It's a really easy concept that the righteousness of Christ is given in a legal sense to the believer. It's imputed righteousness. And propitiation is the turning away of wrath by the sacrifice of Christ on the cross. And so these ideas are, because, we can't just say, oh, believe in God or believe on Christ. And especially in this postmodern world, people are not going to understand even who God is or what believing in Christ means. There is no background information. Not everybody was raised in a Christian home. I'm hoping that all of this will serve to uplift and enlighten the reader, and perhaps if the reader is an unbeliever, that might be the impetus to cause them to have a real spiritual journey of their own. And that is my hope, both to inspire believers, encourage believers, strengthen them, and perhaps to convict and convince someone to start their own journey.
That's wonderful.
Amen to that. Yes, that's a wonderful goal to have, Lynn. And I would say from reading your first book anyway that you are doing very well at meeting that goal. We're getting close to wrap-up time here, ladies. And I wondered, Lynn, if there's anything else that you would like to talk about that you're thinking, man, I wish those girls had asked me that question. Sometimes that happens.
Well, I would only just reiterate that history is so important for us as Christians, for as Christian parents, how we can just learn so much. In fact, I was meditating recently on some of the original documents, because there's so much going on in the world right now that's scary. And so looking back at John Winthrop's speech that he made many years ago when the Puritans escaped persecution and settled in Massachusetts for the first time, and they were facing huge trials. They were facing perils of Indians, and you know, they had to grow their own food, and there was just, you know, they were 3,000 miles away from anything.
Right.
And so there's a really famous speech that he gives. It's called the City on a Hill speech, but it's really not so much political as it is an encouragement of one Christian to another. And he says, we're going to encounter trials. We're going to encounter perils. And he says, now the only way to avoid this shipwreck and to provide for our posterity is to follow the counsel of Micah, to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with our God. And he basically said, we got to love each other. It's the only way we're going to survive. Put aside your own petty stuff and love each other. And that, it seems like a really good advice for today.
Absolutely.
It is certainly, yeah, it is excellent advice at any point in life, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And they also knew that they needed government to be able to survive as well.
Right. And that was exactly what the Pilgrims saw when they came to this country. They realized they were outside the jurisdiction of Virginia, and they promptly wrote up the Mayflower Compact, establishing a local government.
Yes. Well, there's so much that we can learn, Lynn. And, you know, as you know, the premise of our show here is for people to either share a dark time in their life and how they found their way back to light. We've had people who did that. We've had people, though, that do share their ministry, their writing, and how they lead others back to light. And I think you do that in your writing, in the sense that you kind of lead us out of this ignorance. We don't like to think of ourselves as ignorant, but we are really ignorant about a lot of things in regard to history, to our faith, you know. And I think that you really shed a lot of light on that with your writing. So we both want to thank you for sharing so much of that with us today.
Absolutely. I'm sorry, if I may add to that too, in many ways it isn't even an ignorance so much as that it is being naive to things, because if you haven't been exposed to it, you just don't have the opportunity to consider it. And you offer that, Lynn. You offer the ability to consider this by posing these points of history and what transpired. fictionally and non-fictionally. So thank you for that.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because I am first and foremost an educator, and I was never, as a young person, never interested in creative writing. So that is really going to come across as I explore, stories. And sometimes I have to kind of hold back and say, wait a minute, let's not, we're not writing a treatise here. We're writing a story. And and I have a goal and a passion that it should be something positive and should leave you with something. We're not here to bore people. And so that's always been my heart as a teacher.
Well, Jean, I want to thank you for clarifying for me, because I didn't even like that word ignorance as it was coming out of my mouth. Naive is a much more appropriate word. So thank you.
Yeah.
Even
course.
As I said it, I thought that's going to sound horrible. So I want to thank you. Yeah, naive is more the proper term. So I don't want to call our listeners ignorant, or any of us either. So I apologize for that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, ladies, if that's all we have today, then once again, I want to thank you so very much, Lynn and Jean, for today's show.
Thank you,
well,
Patty, and thank you, Lynn, for being a part of it. Yes, this has been wonderful. Great discussion.
Lynn, we wish you much success with your writing, with your third book, and with the first two that are out, and may God continue to bless your writing and your ministry.
Thank you very much.
Listeners, in closing, when you look back on the dark periods in your life, you may find they were not quite as dark as they seemed at the time. And when the light does shine again, it is so much brighter than you remembered. We appreciate you being with us today. Please go to pattysheene.com. That's PattySheene.com. Check the Blog Talk Radio tab at the top. There you will find Lynn's show. And under the More Information tab, you will find ways to connect with her through her website and her social media outlets, and also links to her books. Have a great week. God bless you.
Thank you for listening.
There is a candle in every soul, some brightly burning, some dark and cold. There is a spirit who brings a fire, ignites a